In Andrew Solomon's recent piece in The New Yorker, he explores how these different versions of a family are coming out of obscurity. The legalization of same-sex marriage, in part, has helped pave the way. He writes about polyamory, where you have multiple people in a sexual relationship. He writes about families with asexual partners. And, of course, he includes polygamy, which I guess naturally brought him to Utah. He wanted to see the heartland of polygamy. So he headed south to Hilldale and Colorado City, the center for the FLDS polygamist sect. It's also known as Short Creek.
You know, driving into Short Creek is already a kind of strange experience. There are still quite a few houses that have got the very high walls around them that Warren Jeffs required. And the place is in a state of sort of turmoil and chaos. But it's unbelievably physically beautiful. You have those sweeping red mountains. You have the dusty trails. The things that are growing in people's yards where somehow out of the virtual desert they've managed to provide fertility. And I interviewed a very wide range of people there. People who said over and over again that they would never have entered into polygamous marriage if they hadn't grown up in the FLDS, but who actually found that they really loved one another after having been in such marriages and stayed with them. And then other people who had dissolved their marriages the minute Warren Jeffs went to jail and they felt that it wasn't what they needed to do. One of the people I talked to was Elissa Wall, who was, of course, one of those who brought the lawsuit that ultimately brought Warren Jeffs to justice. She described being pushed into an assigned marriage to a cousin whom she hated, and how unbelievably awful it was to know that she had to marry this person with whom she knew she would have a terrible time. And she stood there on the day of her wedding, and she said she cried so much that she soaked through her wedding dress. She said it was wet and she was heaving, and her mother was standing there and squeezing her hand. And Warren Jeffs himself ran through the wedding ceremony, and he got to the point where she had to say, "I do," and she couldn't say it. And there was a long silence. Her mother squeezed her hand even tighter. And then he ran through the whole wedding ceremony again. And again. She didn't say, "I do." She couldn't say anything. And everyone was glowering at her. And he ran through it a third time. And she finally said it. And she went into this unbelievably horrible marriage that took over her entire experience of the world and from which she ultimately escaped. All of that she's written about. But the thing I found most poignant was that she described meeting her mother again after these many, many, many years. And her mother said to her, "I did what I believed was right." And she said, "I know that you believed that it was right. And I understand why you did it. And I wanted to meet only to show you that I turned out okay in the end, and that I'm actually quite happy in the life that I have." And she said there was this extraordinary forgiveness that took place. And I thought the forgiveness was so compelling for someone who had really suffered terribly, both in the church and in the process of leaving it, that ultimately she had reached the point at which she fully could accept that the intentions were good, and in which she could convince her mother that she had not destroyed her. She said she had lived her whole life with this terrible guilt about destroying my life. And I wanted to take that burden away from her. And I thought, this is what the transformation of Short Creek and the dissolution of that particular church has been about. It's been about people understanding there are different values and different systems, and that people enter into them out of good intentions from all directions. And sometimes they work out, and sometimes they're a disaster. I think that family is the people to whom you have an inevitable and enduring connection. But I also think that parents very much shape their children's perception of the world and their children's idea of what's possible. The thing that was troubling in Short Creek was to meet people who had no idea anything else was possible. The thing that was inspiring was to find that some of those people ended up quite happy in the arrangements that had been made for them. And that was the dichotomy that I wanted to get at. Nobody should feel obligated, either by law or by the rules of their faith or by anything else, to select a way of life that isn't the one that they want and that they believe will be right for them.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Andrew Solomon is joining us to talk about his New Yorker article, which really continues a theme he's been working on for years.
I'm writing a book about expanding ideas of family and about divorce and step families, about interracial families, about single parents by choice or otherwise, assisted reproduction, adoption, foster care, polygamy and polyamory, gay families, paid child care, and the so-called child-free family. So the broadest possible examination of the different ways that people define family. And my contention is that we constantly hold these forms of family to the standard of some sort of ideal 1950s family that wasn't really the mainstream model in the 50s and certainly isn't today. And that actually, if we look at different kinds of families, we find not that we judge their success by how well they meet some prevailing standard, but by embracing their diversity and variety. And I had always been curious about polygamy. I had a few close friends who were Mormons and who were active in the church. I'd had conversations with them from time to time about the idea of polygamy. I just was always intrigued by it. So that was a little bit of a venture into the exotic. And polyamory, I knew people who were polyamorous. And when I started looking at the questions of these two kinds of families, one of which is associated in the popular imagination with the extreme right and the other associated with the extreme left, I thought they actually are in many ways the same thing. And I was very intrigued by that.
You know, there's something that you wrote in Far From the Tree that I wanted to, that I thought applied pretty well to this latest article and the work that you seem to be doing. You wrote about how being different or exceptional is, as you put it, ubiquitous, and that to be entirely typical is the rare and, as you said, lonely state. I guess that theme extends pretty well to this.
Yes, I see this book as a bookend to Far From the Tree. Hmm. Far From the Tree was about how ordinary families dealt with having extraordinary children. And this book is about extraordinary families who produce children who are sometimes quite ordinary and sometimes are remarkable in their own particular ways. But I really think that, the statistics have changed. In the 1960s, I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, and I'm going to be inexact. But anyway, the vast majority of children were growing up in two-parent households in which one parent was a breadwinner and one was devoted to home care, usually the husband earning the money, the wife taking care of the kids at home. It was a very sort of set topic. The marriages were between people of the same race. They were heterosexual marriages. Now I think it's something like 12% of children are growing up in those households. So I really wanted to look at the idea that actually it's not only that that's not the best form of family necessarily, though it can be fantastic. It's also that it's not really what's going on by and large. And if we have a whole culture of people who are all bringing up families that are extraordinary and are trying to make them look like ordinary families, we end up with an awful lot of wasted time and effort.
Hmm. Well, there are a lot of stories in the article. Let's begin with the one you tell it first. This is polygamy. Rich Austin, man in Milwaukee or thereabouts, several years ago, you say, got hooked on the HBO series Big Love. And of course, most are going to remember it was this really great show, I have to say, about a polygamist family of fundamentalist Mormons living in Utah. Talk a little bit about Rich Austin and why you started here.
Well, I started with Rich because he seemed to me to represent a lot of the ambiguities of the situation. Yeah. You know, he is someone who was married to, got married to a woman. He wanted to explore the idea of polygamy. He was already a swinger, but he wanted to have meaningful relationships rather than just have more sex. He ended up recruiting various women and pulling them in. I thought if I started with the stories which are really central to the piece about polygamy within fundamentalist Mormonism, that there are a lot of people who would sort of say, oh yeah, those sort of crazy people at the margins of society. And I was just interested in the idea that this was happening to people who seemed, you know, on the surface in many ways to be quite quite familiar. Yeah. And the women he recruited were all interested in being in a polygamous household. And one of them said, which I thought was very telling, though I think it didn't end up in the article, but one of them said that she had been sexually abused as a child. And she said, I could never feel safe in a house with one man. Mm. She said, but in a house with one man and several women, I actually did feel safe. And I could have the relationship with the man knowing that there were other women around in case anything went wrong. And I thought, oh, this idea of polygamy doesn't have to be based in religion. It can be based in social desire, because so often when people disparage polygamy, they begin from the standpoint of saying, oh, well, it's a kind of religious extremism and therefore totally irrelevant to me. Yeah. And I wanted to open with a story here that would make people think, wow, I guess I could have done this, even if I didn't. You know, the general reader who comes to a story like this, usually very resistant to the idea of polygamy.
One thing you say in the book, this shouldn't have surprised me. I suppose I should know this, but when you're in a place like Utah, what mostly comes to mind when you're talking about polygamy are fundamentalist Mormons. But one of the things you mentioned in the piece that there are various other groups in the U.S. who practice polygamy. Some, I think you say 60,000 or so, and we're talking about Hmong Americans, Muslims of various ethnicities you mention. That surprised me. And so it just got me up thinking that it's much more than just, you know, fundamentalist Mormons when we're talking about polygamy.
I mean, the largest number of people practicing polygamy are without question fundamentalist Mormons.
For sure.
So that's the
yeah.
majority, and that's yeah. the defining community. And that's the community in which I spent the most time.
Yeah.
But yes, there are lots of people who are practicing it, people of various ethnicities, the Hmong people you mentioned. Many of the Muslim Americans are Black Muslim Americans. There are various people of color who are doing this. And then there are people like Rich Austin who are, you know, whom we were just talking about, who are on the surface, at least, in the kind of American dominant mainstream. So it's much broader than I think a lot of people realize that it is. A lot of people who are doing it are very secretive about it, either because it's illegal or because it's stigmatized.
But are you seeing polygamy growing outside of the, you know, the realm of religion or Mormonism? Are we seeing anything like that?
I don't know that I can put statistics to it, yeah. but I would say that the line between polygamy and polyamory is blurring. Polyamory is certainly on the up and up, that many people describe themselves as polyamorous in situations that look a lot like polygamous situations. And then in terms of whether polygamy is growing, you know, on the one hand, people who are in something that they define as polygamy often have children who want nothing to do with it. But on the other hand, they have a lot of children, by and large. And so if only a few of those children choose to pursue it, that still ultimately will represent rising numbers. So I think the sort of there's a balance that goes on there. I don't think it's escalating vastly, but I think it's definitely increasing. Mm.
One of the things the article does is it explores how the legalization of same-sex marriage is now raising, I guess, the expectations of other people who are trying to create different kinds of families outside of these typical norms. How has the legalization of same-sex marriage changed those expectations and the conversation?
There have been several major movements that have opened up and liberalized marriage. There was the women's movement, which made divorce more accessible to larger numbers of people. Because it's generally women who trigger divorces in straight couples. And so that changed the look of marriage when it was no longer something you were obligated to for the whole rest of your life. Then there was the civil rights movement, which was the first time that people said to the government, it's not up to you to say whom we can marry and whom we can't. We can marry the person we love. Then there was the gay marriage movement, which is obviously the most recent and in some ways the most dramatic, in which the idea of marriage was in some ways redefined. And I think all of those movements have contributed to the idea that you can keep legalizing more and more different things. And the arguments made in the gay marriage case were essentially that, you know, the society does not benefit by denying people who love one another the basic rights that are associated in this country with marriage. And the people who are in polygamous or polyamorous relationships have said, you know, if you're not going to say gender is a basis for excluding people from marriage, then why should numerosity, the number of people within the marriage, be a basis for excluding people from marriage? And they, too, I think, would argue, I mean, it's a very large and diverse group, so I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I think they would argue that it doesn't particularly serve government interests to deny their marriages. And then, of course, there are all of these huge questions of, you know, abuse and problems that occur because the marriages are illegal. But the gay marriage fight showed that you could make a really fundamental change in what people thought constituted a marriage. And, you know, I think the people in multi-partner relationships raised their hands and said, you know, what about us? We're next.
Andrew Solomon. His New Yorker article is How Polyamorists and Polygamists Are Challenging Family Norms. It appears in the March 22nd issue of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Radio helps you stay informed, entertained, and connected with your community, and so does your smart speaker, because your smart speaker is also a radio. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home. Never miss a minute.
Stay connected to your community with NPR Utah. Tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Andrew Solomon, author of the best-selling book Far From the Tree. And he's been working on a book about the expanding ideas of a family, polyamorous families, asexual relationships, polygamist families. Solomon says, in the popular imagination, we think of polygamists as being right-wing misogynists and polyamorists as decadent left-wingers. But he says both groups actually share similar goals, even a similar way of life. He has a new article in The New Yorker that is a portrait of these different families, and we asked him to join us to talk about it. I wanted to ask about the practice of polyamory that you explore in the piece. Andrew, maybe explain what it is. It's not religiously motivated, as you say in the story. It's based on, as you say, kind of a utopian ideal of sexual liberty.
Yes, there is a very wide range of practices that comes under the umbrella of polyamory. So it could be just a throuple, you know, one man and two women, or one woman and two men, or three men or three women, or some three-person situation in which everyone has an erotic relationship to everyone else, and they're all involved with one another. They don't have any religious basis for this. They just are happiest in that situation. It basically means that you've got some form of marriage-like relationship among more than two people, and or that you have a sexual liberty within your relationship. You know, as Esther Perel said, it used to be that monogamy meant that you were only supposed to sleep with one person for your whole life. And now we have sequential monogamy, which was actually quite a big change. Yeah. And a lot of the people who are in polyamorous relationships say, well, if it's sequential monogamy, then it's not really quite monogamy. And so what about if we made it not so sequential and we could all do what we wanted and be honest with one another about it, you know, so that marriages don't have to break up because someone has some sexual desires that involve not sleeping with the same person for 50 years and nobody else.
Yeah. I want to come back to the legal argument, because you mentioned how Chief Justice John Roberts, in his dissent of that Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage, he did point out that if you're going to apply these rights equally, you have to take into account other types of relationships, like polyamorous relationships, for example. But, I mean, the thing was, Roberts was sort of saying this as a warning, that all hell is going to break loose if you keep expanding these rights. And gay activists saw that just sort of as a scare tactic. But you say legal scholars are starting to take that actual sort of legal logic. They're starting to take that seriously, I guess.
Yes, Roberts had brought up the question, and Scalia, in his dissent in the Lawrence decision, which was the one that defeated statutes that said that gay sex between consenting adults was illegal, but in his very strongly worded dissent said, you know, once we allow this, we'll take away the laws against adultery and against fornication and against masturbation, and he had a whole catalog of laws that were going to disappear. To me, I read those and I thought, it's absolutely mind-blowing that laws like that are still
right
on the board anywhere. Yeah. I think that the legalization process there is very much underway. And Roberts really, his argument in Obergefell responded to one of the central contentions of Obergefell, where rights were run not because people suddenly felt okay about adults being in these sexual relationships, but because people were concerned about their children. And gay couples had started having children. And what effect did it have on children to be brought up knowing that their parents' union was somehow unacceptable? And so they said, you know, we can't do that to these poor innocent children. Well, people in polygamous and polyamorous relationships have children too. And if we can say it's terrible to make gay marriage illegal or to keep gay unions illegal because that's damaging to the children, Roberts pointed out correctly, I think, that you know, there was no reason not to then go on and say, okay, but if someone is being brought up by three parents, why on earth wouldn't their parents' union being illegal have a negative effect on them? And indeed, as I did this research and explored, it does have a really negative effect on those kids. They have a really, really hard time with it. Now, people in the gay marriage decision community, the sort of activists for gay marriage, said, you know, this is far-fetched and ridiculous. And, you know, the next thing you know, they're going to be complaining that we want to make it legal for, as someone said, women to marry their toasters and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
It was a very sort of radical idea. But I think that that was sort of deliberately naive, because I think if they had said, actually, you're right, we do want to explode the whole institution of marriage, and as soon as you make gay marriage legal, we're going to go on to the next thing, that the whole conversation would have died there. And so I think it was strategic. And I was talking about it with John Powell, who was a big civil rights leader who now runs the Institute for Othering and Belonging at UC Berkeley. And he said, we did the same thing, he said, when the Loving case was on. He said there was all of this hysteria that if we started doing this, everyone was going to end up in an interracial marriage and race would get terribly confused and it would be the end of our idea of American family. He said, and we said, no, it's these very rare exceptional cases. He said, knowing perfectly well that over time it wouldn't be rare exceptional cases. And indeed now, again, I'm not good at holding numbers in my head, but I think about 18 to 20% of marriages in this country now are interracial. So that escalation, you always have to deny it to win the next step in your rights. But the reality is that major change occurs with these shifts.
Well, and one of the changes, of course, people were predicting, well, I wonder what will happen with these state bans on plural marriage. Surely they're going to be challenged. And sure enough, as you write in the article, here in Utah, lawmakers last year downgraded polygamy from a felony to a misdemeanor. Not exactly legalized it, but it was a pretty significant move. So how is the thinking, the idea of legal marriage, that seems to be changing within some of these communities?
I would say that the idea of marriage altogether is of legal marriage altogether. Religious marriage, I think no one has any problem with. Some people argue that it should be more inclusive in particular denominations. But in general, the idea of marriage as a sacrament is fine. But, you know, none of the other sacraments have legal ramifications. And marriage in most countries does not have the legal ramifications it has in the United States. Hmm. But in the United States, if you're married, you can file joint tax returns, you get hospital visitation rights, you get over 1,000 rights that are specifically associated with marriage. As one of the people excluded from marriage by virtue of being polyamorous said, you know, I looked through the list, he said, and I saw one of the things that you get if you're married is reduced admission to admissions fees when you enter state parks.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, we're in a marriage-like situation, but we'd have to pay a full fee when we got to the state park because our relationship isn't recognized. So there's all this legal stuff that kind of clings to marriage. And a lot of people in the larger queer community have felt that, you know, it's great that gay people who want to get married or even trans people who want to get married can do that. It's a real step forward to allow that to happen. But what about the people who actually want to lead a life in which they don't form a single settled relationship? Those people who have always felt marginalized now feel even more isolated on the margin because you've sort of divided gay people into the ones who wear khaki pants and nicely pressed polo shirts and belong to their local church and are leading what looks in many ways very much like heterosexual marriage, except that they're both of the same gender. And then you have the sort of sexual outlaws who remain at the margins. And so a lot of people have said, we don't want the government to come in and further regulate our relationships. What we want is a broader social acceptance of every choice people can make. We're a ways away from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was interesting in looking at the statistics on polygamy and polyamory that when it was couched in terms of being a benefit to children to have a coherent, cogent, and recognized family, there was a lot of support for it. And when there was a discussion of anything that resembled what disparagingly gets called promiscuity, people were very uncomfortable with it and said, no, that's evil and wrong. Even though many of the people who say it's evil and wrong, as seems to be revealed every 15 minutes about people who are activists on the extreme right, are themselves involved secretly in sexual relationships outside their primary one.
You mentioned the statistic that I think it was 4 to 5% of American adults already practice some form of consensual non-monogamy. It's 10 million people. And you say the likelihood is that number is somewhat higher than that. So that seems significant.
It's really significant. And ultimately, I think the question of the piece and of this topic, and even of this conversation we're having is, what exactly is the benefit that the government gets from regulating what constitutes a marriage and what constitutes a family?
Yeah.
You know, there's this idea that actually just let people be in whatever arrangement suits them. You don't have to do it if it doesn't suit you. You know, there was that old line when the gay marriage argument was going on of sort of, if you don't like gay marriages, don't have one. And so I think that's similar in this instance, that you feel like if you don't want to be in a polygamous or polyamorous or multi-person setup, you know, you don't have to be. But how does it actually benefit you to deny that right to other people? And part of what I set out to do in writing this article was to say, these families are not as weird and marginal as you think they are. You know, the women aren't necessarily being oppressed in polygamy. The polyamorists aren't necessarily sort of having sex in front of their children all the time. A lot of the sort of hysteria around the idea of these expansions of marriage rights really are predicated in misperceptions of how people are living. And you know, it's like so many other things. If you meet the people, your point of view changes. My point of view actually changed a lot while I was doing this work. You spend an afternoon with some of these families and you think, well, why the heck shouldn't their family be recognized? And the problem in some ways is that polygamous families in particular, but even polyamorous families, tend to exist within communities of like-minded people. Yeah. So the real move toward gay marriage occurred after the AIDS crisis, when it was much harder for gay people to remain closeted and people realized, oh, we all know gay people. In the 1950s, there was a statistic in which only 1% of Americans believed they had ever met a gay person. And now pretty much everyone in the United States has at least met a gay person, and there are gay people on TV, and, you know, gay life is around us everywhere. And that had to do with the exposure. Not that many people who are outside of these worlds have met the people who are inside of them. They are relatively, in many instances, at least separate communities. And that complicates the push toward legalization. But if you do meet them, and I hoped in writing about them that it helped some people to meet them who would not otherwise have done so. If you do meet them, you come away thinking, well, I mean, that's more of a family than some other legal families I know of. And the resistance gets much trickier to sustain.
Well, along that lines, tell us about the Rev.
So the Rev is a household that was set up by four people who are in a polyamorous relationship. One of them is they all define themselves as transgender, though, you know, it's complicated. They live in New York, and they had been involved with one another for quite some time, and they had a dream of getting a house together and sort of consecrating it to their way of life. And so
Is Jewish, one is Puerto Rican, one is mixed race and Muslim, one is black and mixed race. It's
exactly. Yeah. Yes. So they represent multiculturalism at its widest and most glorious.
Yeah.
And they had what they called a hearthwarming ceremony when they settled in this house. And they committed to one another, and they committed to the land, and they committed to being outspoken activists championing the idea that multiple people should be able to marry or connect to one another. And they live a sort of sweet life there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was not a matter of kind of general discussion exactly who is in how much of an erotic relationship to whom at what time. The person I spent the most time with, who is a brilliant, brilliant person, Andy Isenson, is the only one I believe who is sexually connected to all three of the other partners. But they are all in this kind of utopia that they founded, where the relationship that they have is fully validated and fully accepted.
You know, this question comes up that in any relationship that isn't based on monogamy, the idea of how you divide love came up. What did they say about that? And what did you come to sort of conclude about this idea about how you divide love? Because that seems to be one of those questions that comes up when you're talking about these relationships that aren't typical, I guess.
Well, the great English poet Percy Shelley, who was a champion of free love in the early 19th century and was way ahead of his times in a lot of what he stood for, but he wrote let me see if I can quote it. Love has this different from gold and clay, that to divide is not to take away. And I think a lot of these people would point out that often one feels, I know lots of people who feel, you have a child and you think, but I love this child so much. And if I have another child, will I be able to love that child as much? And if I love the two children as much, what will it take away from the first for me to love a second? And then you have a second child and you think, oh, I can love both of these children so much. And so I think the exponents of this way of life, certainly the people at the Rev, would say that, you know, all four of them love one another. They love one another deeply and profoundly and in ways that are akin to marriage. And that there doesn't need to be a system in which you say romantic love is the only thing that is indivisible and has to be focused on one person. I mean, Andy Isenson, again, who's in the Rev, talked about the idea that we sort relationships into these two categories, people we have sex with and people we don't have sex with. And we've said that those are two totally inseparable categories and that only one person should be in the first category. And he said he doesn't, or they don't, rather, they prefer the they pronoun, that they don't see a need to make those separations, and that you can have a variety of people with whom you have a variety of relationships. And, you know, love is not distributed in a finite quantity where if you apportion some of it here, you apportion less of it there. You can love multiple people.
Well, let's talk about your visit to the Darger family, which brought you here, of course. I suppose you figured you'd have to come here at some point if you're telling a story about polygamy. Tell us about your visit with the Dargers.
Well, I have one old and close friend who has been active in the Mormon community, Greg Prince, who interviewed me years ago for a dialogue about gay marriage and my views on that, so for circulation within the world of the Mormons. And he introduced me to Joe, and I went out thinking, okay, this is going to be interesting and exotic. You know, I've reported from, I don't know, Afghanistan and Libya. This is going to be another sort of wow, wild kind of mind thing. And I met them and I thought, oh, these are really nice people. I was struck by the fact that they're all terrifically bright, intelligent people who have thought about these issues deeply. They aren't people who just tumbled into this because it was required by the church they belong to and they never considered other possibilities. And I was also very struck that the reputation, I think, especially of fundamentalist polygamy, is that it's terribly patriarchal and that women have been somehow brought into it against their will and against their better judgment and against their interests and are sort of stuck in it. And the Dargers seem to me really, well, I mean, not just seem to me, it is the case that the Dargers really love one another. It is clear to me that while Joe is the sort of leader of the family, you know, husbands in heterosexual families are often the leader of the family too, and that the three women all work with one another and work with Joe, and that there is a distribution of decision-making that extends beyond him. And I came away from it and I thought, you know, this is a more intact family than the families of some of the children with whom my son is at school in New York City. I thought, this is a family. And, you know, it's unimaginable to me to have 25 children. I have two children, and that already is often overwhelming. But exactly. So the fact that they have this sort of larger group of children felt more exotic to me in some ways than the fact that there were the multiple wives. And they were wonderfully and refreshingly and bracingly and I think powerfully honest and have been through the whole process of advocating for the decriminalization of and hopefully eventually for the full legalization of polygamy. They are honest about the fact that, you know, the women have had periods of jealousy and one of the women had a terrible postpartum depression at one point and thought about leaving the family. And, you know, it's complicated. But if you know anyone who has an uncomplicated marriage, I'd love their number. They can go on the cover of some new book that I'll do.
Right. So, but when you're talking about polygamy, of course, Andrew, there are those inevitable questions about abuse and coercion and, you know, teen marriage and consent, all of those kinds of things. What does Joe Darger, what did he tell you about those as obstacles to getting this full recognition of polygamy? Because one of the things he said is we need to sort of, own that history, I suppose, or that past.
Yes, he did say that. There was someone else I interviewed. This will ultimately be a chapter in my book, and I did many more interviews than could go into the article. But there was someone else I interviewed who said, you know, the basis for keeping polygamy illegal because of abuse, he said, it's like saying because there's a lot of crime in trailer parks, we should make trailer parks illegal. He said, the fact of trailer parks is not the problem. Yes, there have been terrible abuses associated with polygamy, particularly, I think, in child marriage, the various forms of arranged marriage that have existed in many denominations, with the tendency to exile younger men so that old men can marry pretty young girls, all of the stuff that happens. And then there is the problem, which has also been widespread, of extreme abuse of wives and sometimes of children. And those wives have not felt that they could go to the authorities and say, I'm being abused, because they were afraid that someone would say, you're in an illegal polygamous situation and we're going to take your children away. And because of the Short Creek raid and other raids that have taken place on polygamous communities, the fear of losing children was enormous. And so women put up with abuse, and they put up with, not even neglect, but really mostly abuse of various kinds in situations they never wanted to be in. If you legalize polygamy, then you're at the point where you can actually regulate those relationships. Then, for example, you have some kind of alimony. So if a woman chooses to leave the polygamous marriage she's in, she actually can go through a divorce process and get enough money so that she can take care of the children she has taken out. If she is being abused, she can go to the police and say, I've been being, you know, my husband beats me up all the time and it's a problem, and the police will come in and help. And what happens is that as long as polygamy is illegal and as long as it's pushed to the very margins of society, you have the constant problem of women in particular in polygamous families, and especially in fundamentalist polygamous family, who are terrified to seek help or to acknowledge the nature of their marriage to anyone else. And that, rather than reducing the number of polygamous families, instead enables the abuse that takes place within them. And that abuse is real and it's persistent. It was, of course, at its worst in the FLDS and in all of the sort of Warren Jeff story that listeners will know well. There have been some very extreme instances of it. And look, it is a patriarchal system. There are people for whom that works well. There are people who are brought up that way and then realize that that isn't what they want, women in particular, and who want to break away and have a different way of life. And there has to be scope for people who want to live that way and people who don't want to live that way.
Yeah. Well, we need to talk about Derek Kitchen, because I think one part of the article that's going to get some attention around here is the part about State Senator Derek Kitchen. Let me just explain. Kitchen, I think as most people around here know, openly gay Democratic lawmaker. He co-sponsored the bigamy bill. His name is on one of the lawsuits, of course, that really influenced the Obergefell decision legalizing same-sex marriage. He and his partner challenged the same-sex marriage ban here in Utah. But Andrew, the unexpected twist in the story, I think, is that the conversations with Kitchen was that polyamory sort of emerged. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, I was surprised, I have to say, when he told me about that. But he, when he was with the man who became his husband once gay marriage had become legal in the 10th Circuit, they also had a boyfriend. They had a third. They didn't talk about having a third very much during the original lawsuit, because the original lawsuit was really about marriage, and they felt that it would bring in prejudice against their case to add this additional layer of complexity to it. And so it seemed to me to be the point where, you know, is that a polygamous relationship? Is that a polyamorous relationship? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's to men, so it's not polygamous by the standards of the fundamentalist Mormon church. But what does it mean for them to have had that additional man involved? And then he, having won the gay marriage decision, has since divorced his husband and has said that he wants to bring up children, and he wants to have, in many ways, a family life. But he said, I don't think I would ever do it in the context of monogamy. And so he struck me as a real bridge between the radicalism of the left and the sort of opening of traditions on the right that has obtained in Utah in particular.
Yeah. It was interesting. You said Derek Kitchen was in hiding about his sexuality even when he was the most visible gay person in Utah. And he told you that he thinks marriage is going to fade away. What did he have in mind? And what do you think about that, the idea of marriage fading away in some way?
I very deliberately included two quotes in the story that I felt strongly about. One was Derek saying that marriage will fade away, and Derek is delightful. The other one was Andy Isenson saying in the Rev, he said, polyamory is difficult. If it weren't, everyone would be doing it. And I feel like the reality is that everyone should have complete freedom of choice. Everyone should be able to do whatever they want to. But there are people for whom the traditional, you know, heterosexual two-person marriage and family works really well, and it's not going to die out. Everyone wouldn't be doing polyamory if it were easier. Mm-hmm. Lots of people would rather be in these relationships, partly because they're the tradition, partly because, you know, it biologically, in general, at least until recently, it was two people who made children, and so there was that tradition. And also a lot of fulfillment people find. You know, some people can divide their love without taking away, and some people can't. And so I don't think marriage is going to, the two-person traditional marriage will die out. I just think if we have a really free society, that there will be more people who choose variants on it instead of choosing that mainstream thing.
Andrew, how far do you think this will go, this extension of legal rights to people whose idea of family goes against the norm? Do you think there will be some, you know, ruling that is all-encompassing? Will each particular group have to fight this out separately? You know, will these different families just have to come to be accepted as society becomes more and more tolerant? How do you figure this might play out?
There was someone who said to me that, you know, it was inevitable that the Supreme Court was going to rule on this after they had ruled in favor of gay marriage, that they would have to ultimately rule in favor of polymarriage. But that was when the Supreme Court was differently constituted than it is right now. And I think it's going to be a question that will work its way through the courts. But I also think that the court's decisions tend to reflect public opinion. You know, gay marriage would not have been, there would not have been legislation in favor of gay marriage until the whole society, a majority of the society, began to support the idea of gay marriage. Obviously, its opponents have been incredibly outspoken, but, you know, an enormous number of people came around to it. As I said, because these tend to be more isolated communities, I think the progress may be slower, and the point at which the larger public is able to accept these ideas may be farther away. And I don't think that courts are going to start really ruling consistently in favor of multi-person marriages until there are more of them and more people see them and they're more exposed and open. But if I had an ambition for what I actually wrote, it was to move that conversation forward, to establish that there was a basis for thinking of marriage in broader terms. And I also felt, I mean, I'm the beneficiary of the gay marriage decision. I'm married to my husband. We have a family, as I mentioned. We have a life that was unimaginable when I was growing up. I felt like there was a moral impetus, given that we had sort of left behind the shores of the unacceptable and moved onto the firm land of the mainstream, to say, who's next? Who else is out there waiting for this kind of transformation? Who else can we help to make this kind of progress?
Andrew Solomon, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Solomon. His article in The New Yorker is How Polyamorists and Polygamists Are Challenging Family Norms. It appears in the March 22nd edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. He's also author of the book Far From the Tree. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.